through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36?
You are listening to The Circle Day on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Yadette Gerez. It's an honour to have my guest for this week's show, and I thank her for her time. On the phone line is Dr. Vandana Shiva, who is an Indian scholar, scientist, anti-globalisation and environmental activist, who has authored over 20 books. She is based in Delhi and joins me over the phone from Orissa. Is that how you say it? Orissa?
Orissa, right.
An eastern Indian state on the Bay of Bengal. Let me do a little more of an introduction to do her justice. She is a member of a scientific committee in Spain's Socialist Party think tank. Shiva has fought through activist campaigns, written and spoken extensively about the advances in the field of agriculture and food, intellectual property rights, biodiversity, biotechnology, bioethics and genetic engineering. She has assisted grassroots organisations of the Green Movement in numerous countries with campaigns against advances in agriculture, agricultural development via genetic engineering, and instead has argued for the wisdom of many traditional practices and draws upon India's Vedic heritage. In 1982, she founded the Research Foundation for Science, Technology and Ecology. This led to the creation of Navdanya in 1991, a national movement to protect the diversity and integrity of living resources, especially native seed, the promotion of organic farming and fair trade. She has worked to promote biodiversity in agriculture to increase productivity, nutrition, farmers' incomes and climate resilience. It is for this work she has been recognised as an environmental hero by Time magazine in 2003. She has received many prizes for her work. Welcome so much on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on. Let me ask you the first question. You trained as a physicist and then completed your PhD in the foundations of quantum theory. You later shifted to interdisciplinary research in science, technology and environmental policy. Why did you change your course in life?
Well, I make my decisions in harmony with my conscience, my intelligence, my heart. And when I realized that it was the ecological crisis that really needed addressing, I had meantime got involved as a volunteer in the CHIPCO movement. I said, there's just that much of time you have, that much of a life and that much of a brain. And since the pain of the earth was calling me, I decided to spend my time doing ecological work. And in 82, when I founded the Research Foundation, I'd been invited by the Ministry of Environment of India to do a study on mining in the mountains of the Himalaya, in the valley where I was born. In those days, I was in Bangalore, so I, of course, welcomed the opportunity. And that short study of 6 months led to the closure of the mines because we could show that the costs of mining were so much more than any benefit the government was drawing. And, of course, people were only losing. I'm in Orissa right now to visit farmers, but then activists came running to me to say the local river that supports life in this region, the town, Balasaur, very important during British colonial rule. The farming in this area, more than 120 million litres of water is to be taken out of the river through deep pumps and long-distance pipes for steel mills, paper mills, and the public money of 3 trillion rupees will be used to subsidize this providing. Now, these projects would not survive without these subsidies and without these externalities. So when I realized the true cost accounting of mining could stop mining in my hometown, that's when I decided I'm going to return home and dedicate my life and to service of the earth and service of local communities. And that's what I've done since 1982, full-time, before that, part-time.
And the term tree hugger originates from your younger days as a student when you participated in direct action against the logging industry by hugging trees in order to prevent them from being chopped down. Tell me about this time and what significance do you place in direct action today? And can you talk a little bit about your book, The Violence of the Green Revolution?
Well, you know, I was born in the Himalaya, I was born in the forests of the Himalaya. My father was a forest conservator. I had walked and trekked those mountains. And just before I was leaving for Canada to do my PhD in the hidden variables and non-locality in quantum theory, I wanted to visit some favorite spots that weren't too far, went to this forest and stream. The forest was gone. It was now an apple orchard funded by the World Bank. The stream was gone. I used to swim in it, and the water was not even up to my ankle. And that's when I started to talk to local people, and they mentioned an action that had taken place in the high Himalaya. And I made a commitment that even though I was going to Canada, every vacation of mine, summer and winter, would be dedicated to the movement, which is called Tree Huggers in the West, and it's called Chipko, which means to hug in our language. What did it mean to me? First, it taught me the power of women. You know, women are always called the weaker sex. 11 years they fought and then eventually got a logging ban. It taught me about the knowledge of women. If I was able to write Staying Alive, you know, if you've studied physics all your life, you don't really know how much people know because, you know, you're solving your quantum equations. It's Chipko that taught me that women are the biodiversity experts, the agriculture experts, the hydrology experts. And my respect for people who've never been to school but have deep ecological knowledge because of their life conditions grew. And that's why I started to talk about subjugated knowledges. And that's why I spent so much of my life fighting the piracy. You know, if I hadn't been exposed to Chipko, I wouldn't have known that when a company patents the name, they're just pirating. When Monsanto patents old, ancient wheat varieties, because they don't lead to gluten allergies, they're pirating. And I wouldn't have realized the wealth that is there in our communities. So I always say I went to the University of Western Ontario for my PhD in the foundations of quantum theory, and I went to the University of Chipko in the Himalaya for my learning about ecology, organizing without money, and lasting 11 years in those forests.
And you have said that the soaring seed prices in India have resulted in many farmers being being in debt and turning to suicide as a result. Can you tell us about this?
Well, you know, my interest in agriculture, like I said, my diving into ecological work, activism and research, and for me the two are not separate, began really with Chipko and the mining study of the Doon Valley. My focus on agriculture turned because of 1984, the eruption of extremism in Punjab, the Bhopal disaster, and that's why I wrote my book, The Violence of the Green Revolution, at that time working for the United Nations University. And it was so clear that, again, this myth that India had been fed by the Green Revolution was so false. Actually, food production went down. If you look at food as a whole, commodities, rice and wheat went up, but most of it goes wasted. The soils are dead, the water has disappeared, there's a train that leaves Punjab called the cancer train. Now, after globalization, 1995, Monsanto thinks it has a right to come into our country, and they behave as if there are no laws to be obeyed. They try to introduce GM seeds immediately. I filed a case in the Supreme Court. Their commercialization was delayed to 2002. And they didn't have a patent. They didn't have an intellectual property right. But they started to claim royalty. The figures are off 1,600 rupees charged for a 450-gram packet of seed, which turns out to be more than nearly 4,000 rupees for a kilogram of seed. Off the 1,600, 1,200 was royalty collected by Monsanto on a non-existing patent. And I immediately kept, you know, I kept fighting on this issue. Slowly the government had to intervene. Indian farmers have committed suicide because they were trapped in debt because of these super profits through illegitimate royalties. 300,000 is the number of farmers who've taken their lives. Most of these suicides are in the cotton belt. 95% of the cotton is now owned and controlled by Monsanto, but Monsanto is now in the courts of India because even the government is realizing this is all illegal and illegitimate.
Let's talk a bit more about Monsanto. So Monsanto GM Foods controls 60% of the world's seed market, I've got here, and 94% of seed varieties have been lost. Can you explain what this means for people and how have big companies like Monsanto managed to gain a monopoly of the food industry?
Well, you know, I'm in Orissa, which is the heart of the origin of the varieties of rice called the indica varieties between Orissa and Chhattisgarh. We are saving seeds. I just awarded farmers who have the largest conservation efforts out here. What does the disappearance of seed mean and what does monopoly over seed mean? The disappearance of seed means that you have a drought and you don't have drought-tolerant seeds. I mean, part of the reason the big drought area right now of Maharashtra, Marathwada and Vidarbha, it has got aggravated is because Monsanto's GMO cotton is a hybrid which needs irrigation. Monsanto never tells the farmer you need irrigation. So when they don't have irrigation, it keeps failing and they get deeper into debt. But it also, for when there is irrigation, it's leading to depletion of water. So you lose drought tolerance, you lose salt tolerance, you lose quality of food. You know, Monsanto came to India to patent an Indian wheat variety, because our wheats don't contribute to gluten allergies. Gluten allergies is a result of industrial breeding and industrialization of our food. So there's huge losses when seed disappear. And of course, for the farmer to become dependent on what was theirs, what they have evolved over centuries, means death. It means they end their lives in the case of India.
And let's also go into the area of intellectual property rights that you know much about, and biodiversity, if we can.
Okay, so, you know, the word intellectual property has been cooked up by corporations like Monsanto. Before the GATT, the General Agreement of Trade and Tariffs and WTO, you had industrial property, and it was so clear that industrial property was patents on industrial machines, industrial processes. You couldn't have a patent in on agriculture in India. What they did was lump together everything, lump together copyright, music, writing, and owning the seed to confuse people. Mm-hmm. Now, Monsanto is on record saying we wrote the intellectual property laws of WTO. I'm not saying this. Their representative is on record saying it. What did they want? They wanted a world in which every season, every farmer buys seed from them, and for every crop, they pay royalties. The fact that I heard all this in 1987 and started to save seeds and started Navdanya has meant that farmers have been able to have seed supplied through the community seed banks of the kind I'm visiting right here in Orissa, where we have more than 800 varieties of rice adapted to all kinds of conditions. Aromatic rices, delicious rices, red rices. But more important is the fact that intellectual property rights of the kind that Monsanto has cooked up is such a false leap to declare seed as your manufacturer, seed as your invention. In effect, to saying we are God. That's why I sometimes joke and say, in Monsanto's mind, GMOs means God move over. We are now in charge. Except that they do a very, very bad job.
In 2015, the EU Commission announced its withdrawal of the proposal for a new EU seed law. This comes as good news to you, as you have been fighting against this proposal. What did the legislation entail, and do you think it's the end of the story or the agenda?
Well, you know, when the seed law, which was mischievously called the Plant Propagating Materials Act, came in, the European parliamentarians got in touch with me to read it and to see what this really meant. And I immediately read it and I said, it's a seed law. I worked with parliamentarians in Europe. I went to European Parliament. We did an entire caravan across Europe, Greece, Italy, France to mobilize farmers. These are the biodiversity-rich areas of Europe. And eventually, between Parliament action, 1,200 amendments were made, and grassroots action to say we won't obey. I mean, I've had such fun taking to Europe and taking to the United States the idea of Gandhi's Satyagraha. The Satyagraha for him was ground the force of truth, grounded in truth. And when the British tried to monopolize salt, he did a Satyagraha. Next year will be 100 years of the Indigo Satyagraha, because I don't know if you're aware, we were being forced to grow indigo, and our farmers were starving. And Gandhi led a march to say we will not plant indigo. So that's what we did in Europe, and the Seed Freedom Movement, which is really a global movement, has helped countries across the world to fight these compulsory registration laws. And the reason the Monsantos of the world came up with this is because they had hoped that by the year 2000, all seeds will be GMO. They will own all seeds. It didn't happen because we built movements. They now want to make local seed, farmers' seeds, heritage seeds illegal using laws of uniformity and laws of commodification. So while on the one hand we've had success in rolling back most of these laws in India, in Europe, in Colombia, there's some floating around in the U.S., particularly a California law. It's not the end of the story, because when these corporations have set their mind on owning life and collecting rents from life, they'll keep coming back, which is why we can't give up either.
Yes. And critics of yours have claimed that the solution to prevent India from suffering famine on a mass scale, such as the Great Bengal Famine of 1943, is GM crops. What do you attribute to those events that caused starvation? And where do you stand with the argument that the growing population of humans cannot survive without genetically modified foods?
So first, Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate in economics, has written so clearly that the Great Bengal Famine wasn't because of lack of food, but because the rice that farmers had grown was being extracted as rents, as revenues by the British. It was a result of the empire's greed. And that's why women of that time started a movement saying, Jaan debo, dhan debo, now we will give our lives, we will not give our rice. And this movement then led to the Quit India movement, where Gandhi and others said to the British, Quit India, 42, and by 47 we were independent. When those pushing GMOs say that GMOs are the answer to famine, and we are actually sowing the seeds of famine, they are wrong at so many levels. First, most GMOs aren't food. Most GMOs, there are only four GMOs that account for most cultivation: corn, soya, canola, cotton. Cotton isn't eaten. The other three are going for biofuel. And 70% of the corn and soya go for animal feed. 90% of the corn and soya go for biofuel and animal feed. 10% is eaten. This is not a food system. Secondly, what they produce is nutritionally empty, but full of toxics. And food that harms you, food that causes diseases, is not food anymore. It has become anti-food. Finally, because the costs of production are so high, and the farmer who's taking his life, quite clearly the family isn't eating either, because they have spent everything for getting into a debt trap for toxic seeds. On the other hand, our saving seeds, our growing biodiversity, our doing organic farming is providing all the nourishment we need. And our studies have shown, on the basis of real fields of real farmers, that if we intensified in terms of biodiversity and ecology instead of chemicals, fossil fuels and capital, we could be feeding two Indias and two times the world population. Secondly,
yes, please carry on.
The system of seed sovereignty, organic farming, fair trade is increasing farmers' income tenfold. This is the answer to debt. This is the answer to poverty. This is the answer to hunger. It's proven. And even our government is now waking up to the fact that organic is a better option.
Now, heart disease is a is growing at an alarming rate in India, and a huge number of young people are being afflicted. Last year, it was reported that 12% of those experiencing heart attacks in India are below 40. Ashok, a head of neurology at Mumbai Hospital, has observed a 15 to 20% increase in strokes in the 25 to 40 age group. What does this show you in terms of the change in the cultural diet of India? And perhaps you'd like to talk about monoculture, what the rise of that has meant. So the rise of grains and decline in, the staple diet of India.
So the first is that the Green Revolution meant monocultures of rice and wheat, and this was at the cost of the pulses and the oil seeds and the greens and the vegetables.
Yes.
So already we sowed the seeds of deficiency. On top of it has come industrialization of our food and the dumping of junk food. That has meant not only that people are not eating a balanced diet, but they're literally eating junk food, especially the successful young people who work 20-hour days generating profits for the software industry or the financial institutions are living on hamburgers and pizzas, and I've seen signs of 24-hour food services in these junk products. On every disease epidemic, India is now an epicenter, whether it be diabetes, whether it be hypertension, whether it be cardiovascular diseases or cancer. $300 billion is what Indians are spending on cancer treatment. All of these are related to a bad food system. The toxics in our food, the fact that we used to eat the most healthy oils, coconut, sesame, mustard, and the industry actually works and conspires, just as it does in the seed sector, to try and criminalize local seeds through seed laws. They try and criminalize healthy foods through food safety laws. And on the 30th of January, which is the day of Gandhi's martyrdom, I had to go down to Gandhi's ashram to liberate his ghani, the cold press oil mill, which was being shut down because it was, artisanal oil, cold press, virgin cold press oil, made in front of your eyes, was being declared unhealthy, and hexane solvent extracted GMO soy oil, also loaded with GMO cottonseed oil, is what the corporations would like to push. So our campaign on seed, of seed sovereignty and seed freedom, goes hand in hand with a movement for food freedom to bring back the diversity in our diet and our hand processing and artisanal processing, because that's the food, best food we produce, and women are at the forefront. I have to tell you today, women in the villages had cooked for me forgotten foods, and about 50 dishes of foods that we don't get to see today. This is the excitement in my life. There's so much diversity there to be reinvented, to empower people, protect nature, and reclaim our health.
Let's talk more about your book, Staying Alive, which came out in, that's your first book, I think, which came out in 1988. It helped redefine perceptions of women in developing countries. And in 1990, you wrote a report for the FAO on women and agriculture entitled Most Farmers in India Are Women. Please tell me more about the book, a little bit.
Well, as I mentioned, SHIPCO was the movement that woke me up to women's power, women's knowledge. I mean, I knew my own. I was a feminist. My mother was a feminist. But all the categories that teach us about illiterate people, primitive tribes, I realized so many of them are just artificial constructs. So I wrote Staying Alive really to record my own experience. And then when the UN asked me to write on women in agriculture, I realized most farmers are women. I've done a book with Maria Meese called Ecofeminism. And more importantly, I've just edited a book by writings from women across the world. Some are farmers, some are scientists, and it's called Seed Sovereignty and Food Security, Women in the Vanguard. I think what we're really facing is capitalist patriarchal systems that define women's work as non-work, women's knowledge as not existing. And at this point, where humanity itself is standing at the precipice with a combination of ecological disasters, social disasters, I mean, look at what's happened with Syria. And every society is just ready to explode into disintegration. At this point of time, I do believe if we're going to have a future, it'll be a womanly future, or humanity will destroy itself under the regime of violence that capitalist patriarchy has imposed on the world.
Mm. Now, I'm going to put the last two questions into one big question, so bear with me. India is often talked about now as a growing global economic superpower. Do you view this as success? And can you talk about why you advocate farmers to move away from fossil fuel? And what does this type of sustainability look like? But also, there's an interview on Democracy Now! With you and journalist and historian Gwyn Dyer, I think that's how you pronounce it. You both have opposing views as to the alternatives for the solution of the planet Earth and the global warming rise. His solution is techno-based, where scientists create elaborate ways to cool the planet, but you are coming from a nature-based solution. Can you talk us through the differences of school of thought and why your perspective is better for us in the long run? And what do you propose for the future of food democracy?
Well, to begin with, this arrogance of geoengineering, that we will engineer the planet to get out of global warming and create global cooling, it is just insane. It's unscientific. You don't create artificial volcanoes to block out the sunlight and think you're cooling the planet, because you're killing the planet. When there's no sunshine, there'll be no plants, there'll be no photosynthesis, there'll be no food. If you want to put pollutants in the air to do the same thing, you're going to alter the climate even more and make it more unstable. They talk about it as geoengineering, but in effect, they continue to play games, thinking they are in control when they control nothing because they understand nothing. When I talk about climate change and solutions, it's both on the basis of humble practice, realizing we are part of the Earth, and 30 years of research that shows that in the soils lie all the answers of the fossil fuel age. That is why I wrote the book, Soil Not Oil. This was recognized by the French government at the climate summit in December in Paris last year. And we know that with a 1% increase in organic matter in the soil, not only will we rejuvenate the soil, not only will we get rid of water, famine, and drought, we can address the climate problem by bringing down the stocks of excess carbon dioxide from the air and putting it in the soil. This is aligning yourself with the laws of nature. Proven ways, not more reckless experiments with arrogance and lots of funding from agencies that don't care. It's the irresponsibility and arrogance of that paradigm that, to me, is so disturbing. And part of that arrogance is built into the definition of growth. The idea that if you produce what you consume, you don't produce, therefore women don't work. Therefore, every extraction is treated as growth. You cut a forest, you get growth. You mine a river, you pollute a river, you get growth. And you let the river run and you let the forest grow and you let your children be healthy and let them have food, you don't count it as growth, which is why I do not see the narrow-minded growth obsession as helpful to India. After all, every second Indian child is today severely malnourished. Every fourth Indian is hungry. Our rivers are dying. We are in an ecological emergency. And we can't afford to wait till the economists get their sums right. That's why I travel the length and breadth of our country to give support to movements wherever they are acting. And I know with an alignment with the forces of the earth and a celebration of our earth citizenship and a celebration of our earth democracy, we can stop the insanity of those who are blinded by power and greed.
We have reached the end of our time. Thank you so much, Mandana, for coming on. You are an inspiration, and I know many of your fans are listening right now, and I hope to meet you one day in person.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. You've been listening to The Circle Day on Resonance 104.4 FM. Till next week, turn on, tune in, and kick off.
of times, through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36?